Welcome to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Matt Allagaier. Today I'm joined by the book's editor of The Bookseller, Kathy Rensenbrink. Now, the release of Harper Lee's Go-Setter Watchmen has been the literary event of the year. We'll discuss how this unedited book reads and consider the debate surrounding its publication. As well as that, we'll take a look at two other novels out this month, Early One Morning by Virginia Bailey and The Seed Collectors by Scarlett Thomas. That's all to come here on The Arts Review on Monocle 24. Welcome to the show, Kathy. Let's begin with Go-Setter Watchmen by Harper Lee. The book takes place 20 years after the events in Lee's To Kill a Mockingbird. Jean Louise, or Scout Finch, is all grown up now and returns to Alabama to visit her father, Atticus. But before we discuss the plot, let's clear up the kind of unusual, some might say controversial, circumstances of the book's publication. So what's the story there?
So, obviously, Harper Lee said she was never going to write another book. She led a very quiet life. And then this other manuscript was discovered among her papers. There are myriad conspiracy theories about this. The only sensible way I feel until or unless there's any other information is just treat the book as though it is something that the author wanted to have published, or else you could kind of fall down a rabbit hole of conspiracy, which wouldn't be unfun.
But maybe not that useful.
Well, no, absolutely. So whatever you think about that, it becomes such a huge, big subject. It's such a massive, big red herring that it kind of distracts from thinking about what the book is. What the book is, I think, is fascinating in that it is clearly a first draft of To Kill a Mockingbird, which we know already. We've been told that. It's the book she wrote, and then her editor suggested she have another look at it and expand it and show it from the eyes of her as a young child. Reading it is an amazing experience, I think, as well. Reading it as a writer is an interesting experience because I felt I could see the editorial notes that led from this book to Kill a Mockingbird. And I could imagine the editor saying, like, oh, yes, I really like the stuff with the kids. I think that bit makes Atticus, a little bit less likable. And, right. Maybe there's a bit too much exposition here. But it's completely fascinating. So I think anybody who's interested in the creation of books and how books come into being would find it a fascinating read. And I think a very heartening read for anybody who has a first novel that isn't quite there, that they could go through it and look for what's going to turn their book, what's going to be the transformational piece, because there's probably something in it that's their own To Kill a Mockingbird moment.
Right, I see. Okay. I mean, you mentioned this is a manuscript and it's unedited. Do you think the book would have been improved vastly by having an editor?
Well, I think it was, and that's what became To Kill a Mockingbird, which is a far superior book. This book is definitely sufficiently different to merit it being a very interesting read. And I think you can, again, all the editorial decisions made around it, I think, were very good. It's a hard read because obviously they were grim racist times and I felt very oppressed by reading it, which I don't think you do in Mockingbird so much. I mean, Mockingbird, I think, is a shocking read as well.
But partly because it's from a child's perspective.
I think the exuberance of the children kind of gets you as the reader over the just the difficulties of the bile of all these horrible people. And then in Watchmen, it's much less like that. I found, I read it in the morning and later on that night, I was feeling really sort of miserable and drippy. And I realised it was because I just felt very affected by the book, which of course, and one of the things I think that's interesting about reading both books is they just are so shockingly, frighteningly, hideously relevant to what's happening in America now. So absolutely. I definitely fear, not that I would in any way think I have a handle on race relations in America, because I don't, but I definitely do feel when you look at when you look at black churches being burnt in the States, which I think is so difficult to grasp, and then you read these books and you think, well, yes, given that things were like that such a short time ago, it's no surprise really that there's this awful legacy.
Absolutely. Let's move on to the plot now, because people picking up this book, huge fans of To Kill a Mockingbird, and there are lots of them, they should probably be warned, because Atticus in this book is a different character, isn't he?
He is different. I'm not sure I don't think in some ways he's that different. There's a wonderful bit in it when Jean Louise is shocked by his, I mean, he is, he kind of is against, he's pro-segregation. And Jean Louise, Scout has grown up in the book, is shocked and horrified by that. And there's this bit where she says, I wished for a time when, she said, I would like to run back to New York and just make him into a dream. Just Atticus, Jem and me in a time that was simpler and when people didn't lie. Because in this version of the book as well, Jem is dead. Her brother is dead, which, again, we know that from the opening page, so I don't think it's too much of a spoiler. And again, that's the paragraph. I think the editor said, you know what, show us that innocent time when people didn't lie, when we've got Atticus and Jem. What is fascinating about it from the point of view of literary biography is there's always been this idea that Atticus was based on her own father and Jem based on her own brother, who did die very suddenly. I found the death of Jem in the book was a bit lightly dealt with as well.
Okay.
Not tremendously explained. And at some point, you know, because I think we know that it only happened 2 years ago. But it's a novel, really, I think, about a girl potentially grieving for her brother and being disillusioned by her father and sort of growing up and realising that a lot of the people in the place where she grew up hold pretty unpleasant views.
Right. I guess the sort of structure of it is a woman returning back to her childhood home. Mm-hmm. That's a literary trope we see a lot, and it's used a lot. Do you think Harper Lee brings anything unusual that we haven't seen before to this formula?
No, again, I think the unusual is what we get in Mockingbird. This is a fascinating book to read, but it's fascinating because it's the precursor to Mockingbird. It would otherwise be, I think, socially interesting. It feels like a time capsule book, you know, which it obviously is, sort of hidden in the straw. But if it had been written by somebody else and discovered by someone now, it wouldn't be being published to great acclaim. There are lots of sort of first novel mistakes in it. And again, there's no shame in that, because that's what editors are for. If anything, this book is a tribute to the editorial process. But there are first novel mistakes. You know, there's pages and pages of quite hefty dialogue. And again, it's very much of its time, horribly racist. And even Jean Louise, who's the sort of the non-racist one, says things that, with the modern sensibility, seem very shocking. And then at one point, again, a man hits a woman to kind of calm her down. It's sort of okay, you know.
Right. So that's the world it is, okay.
Yeah.
Ghost Eder Watchman by Harper Lee is out now, published by Heinemann in the UK and HarperCollins in America. Let's move on now to Early One Morning, the latest novel by Virginia Bailey. We should set the scene, I guess, for this one. It opens in Nazi-occupied Rome in 1943, where we meet our protagonist, a young woman named Chiara Ravello. She rescues a young boy who has just been herded onto a truck with his parents. Cathy, how does the relationship between the two develop over the novel?
Well, I think the novel hinges on precisely that moment, and it's such a strong moment. It is early, and the scene is set so well. And the moment, I think, that the whole book hinges on so beautifully, it's the moment when Chiara Ravello, which is a wonderful name, isn't it? I just want to keep saying it. Chiara Ravello. The moment when Chiara Ravello just locks eyes with this young Jewish mother. And in that moment, the mother sort of just pushes the child towards her. And she just decides to take him. And I think it's certainly reading it... I have a boy who's about the same age as the boy in the story, so that probably did. I could just absolutely imagine it. Right. I could imagine being the mother and knowing that you were heading into doom and pushing your darling little child away from you to someone else. And I could imagine being Chiara Ravello and taking the child. But of course, after that moment of sort of heroism, really, on her behalf, the relationship develops difficult. And I think that's one of the good things about this book as well, because I think so many of these stories, there is the temptation towards sentimentality, you know, who wouldn't be grateful to be rescued? But of course, this little boy doesn't know he's supposed to be grateful. And he's just actually lonely and homesick and misses his mother. And Chiara Ravello doesn't really know anything about children, so doesn't really know how to be with him. And I think the structure of the book is so fascinating, because there's this moment of beautifully, lyrically drawn rescue, and then the difficulties that everybody has in accommodating the kind of the real humanness that hides behind that.
Right. I mean, so the scene kind of hops from 1940s Italy, where we start, to 1970s Wales. And the story kind of changes in a way from a Holocaust novel to then becoming a family drama. Mm-hmm. How successful is that shift, do you think, both of those shifts?
I think it is successful. One of the things I was thinking about was, I always think it's good in novels where you have something that's happening, where you have a strand of the action happening in the past and you have a strand happening in the present day. What I feel is always slightly less successful, and I can never work out whether this is just an irrational preoccupation of my own, and it's the case in here, is... obviously, it's not happening in the present day because it's happening in the 70s. And the time frame has to work because of the various plot things, which I won't spoil, and the ages at which people have children and all that kind of thing. That is the appropriate time frame. But for me, I think there's something that never fit. There's a definite clarity to having things happening in the present day right now rather than just another strand that is also set in the past. And I think then a problem of a problem for the reader to kind of slightly know why to care as much as you would if it's happening in the present day. It's sure. quite a technical point. I don't really know the answer to it. But I always find with books that work on this structure, I feel much more engaged if the other strand, if the non-historical strand is happening in the actual present day rather than another historical past.
That's interesting. Okay. Kiara is obviously our main character and she's very much the focus of the narrative. Some people have said that Daniele, who's the little boy who then grows up, he's a bit of an unknown at the heart of the novel. Do you think we need to know more about him or is that on purpose, do you think?
Well, I mean, I kind of think, again, when you read novels, you want things to turn out well. So I think, I think that's one of the very good and skillful things about this novel. It frustrates our desire for the happy ending because we want, you know, after this moment of heroism, after this little boy has been saved, we want everything to go very well. And we want to be left with this image of him just like looking happy, sitting on his new stepmummy's knee. But of course, like, why should he?
Yeah.
In the climate that it was, how can we expect this boy to be anything other than very, very troubled and traumatized? So I think that's certainly a very good message for sort of society.
Right.
But again, it leads to attention in the book because you can feel, as a reader of fiction, you feel that that's sort of slightly not what as a reader you want to have delivered to you.
Right. We're maybe too used to the Hollywood.
I think so. I think it's why we read fiction because all fiction has resolution. So, and I think we're always reading towards resolution and feeling kind of distressed when that resolution isn't given to us as readers.
Right. Interesting. Early One Morning by Virginia Bailey is out today in the UK, published by Virago. Our final book today is The Seed Collectors by Scarlett Thomas. This, her ninth novel, sees a family trying to deal with their own lives and sense of mortality after the death of their great-aunt Oleander. How does the novel work, Kathy? Is there one main protagonist or are we kind of following multiple family members throughout the
book?
We're
following multiple family members and it's extremely good fun. This okay. is basically a kind of a whole orchard. It's all about botany, so it's an orchard. It's a flower field. I've got to keep reaching for more words. It's a whole family tree. They're called gardeners. A whole family tree of very peculiar, eccentric characters. I completely loved it. So great aunt Oleander has died. They've all been named after flowers as well. So they're all called things like Fleur and Clem and Bryony and Holly. And everyone's under this duty to carry on living through the family relationship with nature. But as one of them says, you know, I don't know why people think nature is nice. It's just trying to kill us all the time.
Yeah, Thomas has written already 8 novels. This is her 9th. How does this compare to some of the other works?
Oh, it's probably my favourite of all her books. I think she's an amazingly talented, brilliant, miraculous writer. And I loved this. I loved the way... well, it is so much fun, and I do like that as a reader. I think there's always a bit of an idea that our literature has to be hard, whereas this is just riotous, gorgeous, full of flamboyant escapades. So Bryony, for example, who's extremely fat and can't control her addictions, there's this wonderful bit where she goes off on this splurging shopping spree. She's buying things and eating things and drinking things and thinking about sex. I probably shouldn't go on about the sex too much because I could probably burn out everything because it is extremely sexy and sexual and sensual. Lots of people through it are thinking about sex, having sex, not just the plants, you know, the people as well.
Right, okay.
But it's fun, and narratively it's interesting because the narrative baton sort of passes between each of these characters, so we keep seeing it from different point of view. I felt like it was kind of, the book itself feels like an unruly tree or an unruly, you know, when you see those vines over houses and they're just losing control and going off on their own, it's a bit like that. But in a good way, I think it's all intentional.
Right. We should mention there's kind of a fantastical element to the plot as well. I mean, the great aunt Oleander, she leaves some seeds for each of her family members. And there's also a magic book as well.
Yeah. So the seed pods are, they supposedly hold the secret to enlightenment. But other members of the family went off in search of their source, a faraway island, and all disappeared and died. So there's all that bit, which again has a nice sort of underpinning to it. Certainly for me, it really worked almost just as a sort of a comedy of manners with very, very odd people. And then the interesting bits that, and I wouldn't at all think of myself as being interested in botany. So I did quite like learning a little bit about plants. along the way, which I felt with all her books, actually. There's definitely something about reading a novel of hers. You kind of finish it having been on this roller coaster ride, which includes having learnt things.
Okay, interesting.
You definitely feel she's just got such a massive brain, I think, the author. She's kind of, you wouldn't be surprised to find out if somebody said, like, oh, yes, we tested her and her brain is 30% bigger than everybody else's. It's a massive brain full of all these sort of drawers, flower beds full of inspiration and thoughts and creativity all sparking out in a peculiar way.
Right. And she's also got an amazing writing style, hasn't she? I mean, she's very kind of witty and dry and sarcastic. Do you think that works perfectly for this kind of novel? It's quite satirical.
Yeah, completely. It's just so much fun. It's so much fun to read. But you really feel... again, it is absolutely a work of literature, but I think as the reader, you feel entertained. You feel as the reader that she is thinking about you and your journey, whereas I sometimes think some literary novels slightly exist in a vacuum. I'm just going to sit here and be a literary novel, and if you, reader, want to approach me, then that's up to you. Whereas you feel with this, she's really thinking about your enjoyment and tempting and teasing you all the way through the various roller coaster bits that this, the twists of the vine all the way
right.
through.
She's out to entertain. Fantastic.
Definitely, yes.
The Seed Collectors came out earlier this month and is published by Canongate Books. And that brings us to the end of today's show. My thanks to Kathy Rensenbrink for joining me today. Her book, The Last Act of Love, is out now, published by Picador. You've been listening to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Matt Alagaya. My producer was Holly Fisher. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow with our film review from Japan. But for now, goodbye from me and thanks for listening.